Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Mohammed Chaudhry, President and CEO for the Silicon Valley Education Foundation, and your moderator for today's program. Our guest today is veteran journalist Dale Russakoff. Since 2010, when Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg announced his $100 million pledge to improve Newark, New Jersey's decaying education system, Dale has followed the plans for school reform every step of the way. What began as a serialized column for The New Yorker has become her first book, The Prize, Who's in Charge of America's Schools? Her reporting delivers a riveting drama of our times, encompassing the rise of celebrity politics, big philanthropy, extreme economic inequality, the charter school movement, and the struggles and triumphs of schools and students in one of our America's poorest cities. She details how the well-intentioned and well-funded urban education reform effort in Newark fizzled in the face of titanic struggles between the sometimes conflicting interests and ambitions of the politicians and policymakers, school administrators and teachers unions, community members, and the hopeful, if often frustrated, parents and their children. The tragic outcome of this friction left students with unfulfilled promises for a better education and their dreams for a life beyond poverty. While Newark failed to be the model for successful reform Zuckerberg intended it to be, Dale holds it up as a powerful example of the systemic problems facing America's most underserved school districts and the communities which rely on them. Dale lives in New Jersey and spent decades of her career writing for the Washington Post covering politics, education, and social policy. She's the mother of two grown children and hails from Birmingham, Alabama. We are thrilled that Dale Russakoff's travels have brought her to San Francisco. Join me in welcoming Dale Russakoff.
Thank you so much for having me here, and thank you for the great introduction. I wanted to start by telling you why telling this story became so important to me as a journalist. It began literally the day of the announcement of Mark Zuckerberg's gift to Newark. I had seen an article in the local newspaper saying that a gift was going to be announced on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And I had never watched Oprah, but I made sure to watch on September 24th, 2010. I was absolutely electrified to see this very young billionaire pledge $100 million to the Newark schools, and also to hear Cory Booker, then the mayor of Newark, and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, talk about using it to revolutionize education in Newark, to do what so many people agreed was the most important challenge in the country, at last to make public education work for the nation's poorest children. To me, $100 million sounded like all the money in the world. And Booker, Christie, and the reform leaders who praised them, including Education Secretary Arne Duncan speaking for President Obama, sounded so sure of themselves. "We know what works," was their phrase. They would take the best ideas of the education reform movement, bring them all to Newark, and in Booker's words to Zuckerberg, they would, quote, "flip a city." I didn't believe that they would achieve change on the almost miraculous scale they were talking about, but I expected to see dramatic advances. I wanted to get as close to this process as I possibly could, because this is exactly what has fascinated me through my almost 40 years as a newspaper reporter, tracing the process by which big public policy ideas do or don't translate into actual changes in people's lives, and understanding why or why not. I saw what was happening in Newark as an opportunity to explore how the democratic process worked, or didn't, for very disadvantaged children. I also thought it was an opportunity to look from the ground level at the workings of the education reform movement, this very potent combination of billionaire philanthropists, charter school leaders, social entrepreneurs, and politicians in both parties who are seeking to upend the status quo of traditional public schools governed by large, usually unionized bureaucracies. I was well aware that the movement had provoked a furious national debate over the shape of education. When I started my reporting, the movie Waiting for Superman just had come out, portraying traditional urban public schools as failure factories, teachers' unions as villains, and non-union charter schools as the solution. Two dueling websites on education had just gone online. One was called waitingforsuperman.org, and the other, notwaitingforsuperman.org. As a neutral observer, a journalist, I was struck by how many real issues both sides, the reformers and their opponents, were leaving out. This impassioned national debate had a huge hole in the middle of it, and a majority of the children in Newark and in cities across the country were stuck in that hole. I'll give you two illustrations from my reporting early on. For most of the first year after the gift was announced, Newark did not yet have a superintendent. A group of consultants was scripting an overhaul of the district, which was being run by the state. These consultants did some very important work, in particular, getting a handle on the district's chaotic tenure process. But the most public thing they did was to identify which of the absolutely worst district schools to close to make room to expand charter schools. One school they identified was 15th Avenue School, where for years, barely 20% of children had been reading at grade level. Very little was going right for children at this school, so it was designated to close, and one of the highest performing charter schools in the state was to move in. This charter, as was its model, was going to start with kindergarten and grow one grade each year, so no one currently at 15th Avenue, a kindergarten through eighth grade school, would be eligible to go there. The consultants recommended that the 330 children at 15th Avenue be transferred into a school just across a park, which is what happened. Now, if you were looking at a map, this made perfect sense because the second school was geographically close and it was also underpopulated, so it had plenty of room. But if you knew the neighborhood at the ground level, which the consultants didn't, you would know that Westside Park is a hangout for drug dealers and gang members, and that children as young as 5 or 6, or even 12 or 13, should not be walking through it every day to get to and from school. I attended a PTA meeting at 15th Avenue, and parents were terrified. They wanted to know how people who profess such concern for their children would come up with such a plan. Moreover, the school where they were going wasn't much better than 15th Avenue. One father said, "They're not solving the problem. They're just taking the problem and moving it across the park." So the reformers had a really powerful diagnosis for what was wrong with the existing system, but they didn't have a formula for fixing it without causing tremendous stress for Newark children in the district schools, where the majority of kids are still being educated. One thing I learned about education in cities, it's an ecosystem. Changes in one area have consequences in another, many of them unintended. Okay, scene two. I attended a public forum that was held one Saturday morning on a new alternative high school graduation test. For the past several years, students who failed the regular exit test had taken an alternative test that was much shorter and easier and was graded by their own teachers. So, everyone passed. The state was proposing to use a new test that would raise the bar and would be graded by a disinterested party. A number of civil rights organizations participated, and they argued strenuously against the new test. They had calculated that some 3,000 students in New Jersey who would have passed the test under the old system would fail it under the new one. As they put it, one of the most consequential things you can do to students who have the credits required to graduate is to deny them a high school diploma. I found myself wondering, how about denying them a high school education? If students couldn't pass this very basic test, what did a high school diploma mean? Again, here was a forceful, impassioned, important voice in the education debate talking past some of the biggest problems children were navigating every day in Newark and in cities like it. It seemed clear to me this was an opportunity for journalism to write a comprehensive account of how both the status quo and the reforms were affecting all Newark school children in charter schools and in district schools. I wanted to see education from every perspective in the debate, but most importantly, from the eye view of children and the teachers who worked every day to reach them against incredible odds. If I could write a story, a book, about education reform in Newark that was indisputably true and thorough, essentially filling in the hole that existed in both sides of the national conversation, I hope that it would spur a more honest conversation about what children in schools in cities like Newark truly need to succeed. What should this conversation look like? I actually have a suggestion. Newark and other urban districts desperately need to get more resources to classrooms to support children and their teachers. The reform movement has a mantra. It says poverty is an excuse for failure in district schools in Newark and across the country. That is unquestionably true for some people in some schools. But as I witnessed continually, poverty is also a root cause of failure for children who literally are traumatized from growing up amid violence, family strife, and constant instability. Here's another example from my reporting. Avon Avenue School is located in one of the poorest catchment areas in Newark. I regularly attended a kindergarten class there of 26 children, of whom 15 had child welfare cases, alleged neglect, exposure to violence, exposure to drugs. Some of the children in that class were already so angry at age 5 that they routinely would hit other children and throw chairs. So not only were these children unable to learn, they frightened some classmates to the point that they couldn't learn either. That class had one of the best teachers in any Newark charter or district school, but on many days, her extraordinary skills weren't enough to overcome those challenges. She did not need excuses. She needed help. I also spent time in Spark Academy, a KIPP elementary school, a charter school. Spark had some students, although not as many, who were equally troubled. They also had way more resources to support them and their teachers. They had 2 teachers in classrooms from kindergarten through 3rd grade. They had a tutor for every grade to push in and support children who couldn't keep up even with 2 teachers. They had 3 social workers who did therapy with a total of 70 children a week, while Avon Avenue had the equivalent of 1 social worker. And Spark had a dean of students and family engagement whose job it was to make sure that there was an adult in each child's life to support the child's learning, if not a parent, a family friend, a godparent. The principal of Spark said there was no way the school could have had the superior academic results it did without those extra resources. Spark had these resources because KIPP gets more money per pupil to its Newark schools than the Newark School District does, even though it starts out with less. The Newark District schools, like those in many old industrial cities, have been used for generations to do much more than educate children. They have variously been a patronage pit for local political bosses and also an employment agency to counter poverty and instability in the city. The district has jobs and sweetheart deals with contractors that no longer serve the schools or the education of children, if they ever did. Every stakeholder in education, from state governments to unions to parents to politicians to local community organizations to the education reformers, ought to figure out how to get as many of those resources to children and the teachers and principals who know their needs best. Philanthropists also could be part of this broader conversation. The role of private philanthropy in public education has shifted dramatically in recent years. For generations, the foundations of deceased early 20th century industrialists dominated education philanthropy. Since around the year 2000, living billionaires have displaced them. Bill Gates of Microsoft, the Walton family of the Walmart fortune, Eli Broad, the California insurance and retail magnate. They are making targeted, very large donations in hopes of disrupting the existing education system, which they see as antiquated and unequal to the task of educating the next generation. That's the context in which Mark Zuckerberg came to pledge $100 million to Newark. These philanthropists tend to invest in charter schools as a hopeful alternative for children stuck in troubled public systems. And while charter schools do not outperform traditional public schools on a national basis, children in Newark charters do dramatically better than their district school peers. And the money donated by Zuckerberg and others is doubling the number of children in Newark charter schools, which is in most cases a significant improvement for those children. But 60% of children remain in district schools, and the public system is in distress, in part as a result of the exodus of children and dollars to charter schools. To make ends meet, the district has been closing and consolidating schools, laying off social workers and other support staff, and transferring thousands of students. In kindergarten through 8th grade in traditional public schools, performance has actually gone down, not up, in the years since the Zuckerberg gift. This gets back to the issue of education as an ecosystem, in which everything is connected to everything else. Until now, charter proponents and their philanthropic backers have not seen these kinds of unintended consequences as part of their responsibility. When I asked Cory Booker at the outset how failing schools would turn into high-performing schools, he said, and I quote, "They will melt into many different school models. They're going to flower just like the cherry blossoms in Branch Brook Park." Clearly, no one had a roadmap for the treacherous path from failure to utopia. There's evidence that this problem has prompted some real soul-searching in the education reform movement. A prominent scholar in the movement actually said there should be a sort of Pottery Barn rule for proponents of disruptive change in existing school districts. You broke it, you bought it. Perhaps this will be an agenda item for Eli Broad as he seeks to expand charters in Los Angeles to enroll 50% of the district's students. If there is not a plan to stabilize the remaining district schools, the children they serve will pay a price for education reform. I'd like to back up and tell you a little about Newark. It's a city of 270,000, about a 20-minute drive from Manhattan, and it is in many ways a metaphor for America's urban crisis. One of the 20 largest cities in the country until the Depression, it was undone by the collapse of manufacturing, the flight of whites and the middle class to the suburbs, and disinvestment. The school system collapsed along with the city. And it had become so corrupt and so neglectful of children that in 1995, the state of New Jersey seized control of it. One statement in the investigative report said it all. The longer children remain in the Newark public schools, the less likely they are to be successful. The state had been in control for 15 years at the time that Booker and Christie came together to try to reform the system, and there had been only minimal improvement. Only 40% of students were reading or doing math at grade level. Only 54% were graduating from high school. And of those who did, 90% needed to take remedial courses before taking college credits at the local community college. Booker and Christie wanted to expand charter schools, close failing district schools, revolutionize the teachers' union contract so as to fire the weakest teachers and reward the best ones with merit pay, and create a state-of-the-art data system for the remaining district schools to hold everyone accountable for student improvement. Booker told Mark Zuckerberg that with his help, they would flip a whole city. With charter schools and a district that ran like a high-performing business, they said they'd arrive within 5 years at a model, a proof point, that Zuckerberg, with his philanthropy, could take to one city after the next, solving the education crisis in all of urban America. That's the context in which Mark Zuckerberg came to pledge $100 million to Newark, a city which at that point he had never visited. Zuckerberg did end up spending $100 million in Newark, and the matching funders spent a second $100 million, but 5 years have now lapsed, and there is no model of educational excellence in Newark. They spent $60 million expanding charter schools, and within a couple of years, charters will enroll 40% of Newark children. According to the new superintendent in Newark, this means that 42% of African American students will attend a school that outperforms the state test, that outperforms the average state test score for all African Americans. That is a sizable increase. They also spent about $50 million on a new teacher's contract that holds teachers more accountable for effective instruction, but doesn't revolutionize the pay scale as hoped. And they spent $20 million on consultants, many of them paid $1,000 a day, to implement what they called systems change at the district level, a new teacher evaluation system, a single enrollment system for both charters and traditional public schools, a system monitoring which high school students are and aren't on track to graduate. But this did not flip a city. That promise was a bit outsized from the beginning, but one flaw in the reasoning was contained in an email that an aide to Booker wrote early in the negotiations over Zuckerberg's gift. It said, MZ's money is not going to the classroom. As I said, the emphasis was on systems and management changes, running the school district like a business, expecting better management to travel through the system and show up as better student performance. The reformers weren't wrong to emphasize systems change in a district whose management was borderline dysfunctional, but they emphasized it to the exclusion of figuring out how to get more resources to schools and classrooms for children who are years behind academically or who simply can't learn because of trauma from their daily lives in Newark. Had they engaged the best teachers and principals in Newark, in district or charter schools, in planning their agenda, they might have taken a different approach. But this entire plan was formulated without the input of Newark residents or educators. In fact, they learned about the revolution coming to their schools at the same moment as Oprah's national television audience. Mark Zuckerberg seems to have learned a lot from this experience. He and his wife, Priscilla Chan, have announced that they will continue contributing to the cause of education for the most underserved children, but from now on, they'll work close to home in the Bay Area. They said they will work to understand the desires of communities and the complex needs of children they hope to help, a very different approach from the one in Newark. Within the very polarized national discussion about education, there's a debate over whether you can improve urban school districts without first solving poverty. My reporting convinces me that you don't have to solve poverty to improve education for the poorest kids, but you definitely have to address it. And to address it, you need more resources at the school level. I'd like to return to the Kipp Elementary School I mentioned, Spark Academy, to tell you about something I witnessed that clarified this for me. One morning late in 2011, a mother of three students at the school was badly beaten by her boyfriend while her children were in school. The mother appeared in the school office, her face bleeding and swollen, clutching her newborn baby, whose skull had been fractured. She was desperate for help. The principal, her name is Joanna Belcher, accompanied her and the baby to the hospital, persuaded her to file a police report, and accompanied her to the courthouse, where they sat together for hours waiting for a lawyer to be assigned. The lawyer who eventually was assigned told me, "I had never seen that in all my career, a principal coming to court with a victim." But even more unusual was what happened back at the school, where the Dean of Student and Family Engagement took up the case. This is a position unheard of in district schools, a dean responsible for developing individualized help for children who are struggling because of issues outside the classroom. The dean created a carpooling schedule involving seven different staff members who would pick up the three children each morning at a neutral location. The family had moved to a shelter whose address was secret, and returned them each day after school. The school also had three social workers who did therapy for 70 children a week suffering from emotional distress. District schools had only one who had no time to do therapy. The lead social worker at the Kipp School held counseling sessions with the children and also guided their teachers on how to speak with them about the traumatic experience to help them feel safe and able to learn. Not one of those children missed even one day of school throughout their months in the shelter, and all of them finished the year above grade level. I had many discussions with district school teachers about this issue of resources at the classroom level. A district school teacher put it this way to me: "We have to ask of every school, what does this particular school need in order to meet the challenges of the neighborhood it's situated in? And then we simply have to find the courage and the money to provide it. We have to be able to show children, why is this education meaningful? And how can you possibly do that if so many other things are not working?" Thank you very much.
And we will be taking audience questions. If you have them, there'll be someone. If you hold them up, someone will come by and grab them from you, and we'll make sure we incorporate as many as we can of those questions into the conversation with Dale. So, thank you. That was a fascinating story. So, tell us a little bit more about Newark. There's 270,000 people, and there's a Newark right up the street in California as well. I assume we're not talking about that one.
No,
where
not,
is Newark and why Newark?
Yeah. Where is Newark?
Why Newark? But how many students? What's the poverty level? How far is it from New York City?
Well, it's just really, it's just across the Hudson River from New York City. It's about a 20 to 25 minute drive. Why Newark for Mark Zuckerberg? Is that the short answer is he was swept off his feet by Mayor Cory Booker. Booker just told him that, Booker had a way of marketing Newark to philanthropists, and he was very successful at raising a lot of money for all kinds of things with law enforcement and with economic development, and he had a way of saying that Newark, he talked about it as, a proof point. I think he dealt with a lot of venture capitalists, and they saw, he said that Newark was small enough that you could make dramatic changes in areas that were, in most cities, intractable social problems, and then up Newark.
Yeah. Was he just swept off his, was Zuckerberg just swept off his feet by Cory Booker's personality and his pitch?
Yeah, they met at a, in Sun Valley, Idaho, at a retreat for billionaires and celebrities and politicians. I haven't gotten invited yet, so.
I see.
But anyway, it turned out that that Mark Zuckerberg had just decided he had signed the giving pledge with Warren Buffett and Bill Gates to say that he would give away half of his wealth in his lifetime, and he was ready to make his first gift, and he had let it be known in a small circle of people that he wanted to do, quote, something big in education. And it turned out that somebody in that small circle knew Cory Booker and told him, and and Booker was at that very moment working with Christie to try to come up with this reform plan and looking for a philanthropist to help fund it. And so they happened to meet, and he gave him the pitch. As somebody said, Cory Booker did his Cory Booker thing. And Mark Zuckerberg said afterwards that after he heard him talk, he just said, this is someone who can create change. This is somebody I want to invest in. And it happened very quickly after that.
And Zuckerberg, there was a movie during that time you talk about in your book, and it was not related to the movie or anything. This wasn't a PR play for Zuckerberg.
Right.
And
there
Facebook.
Was a lot of, you know, everybody assumed because this gift was made the very weekend or the Friday of the very weekend that the movie The Social Network came out, which had a very unflattering portrayal of Zuckerberg. And so there was a lot of thought that, oh, he was doing this, you know, as a PR ploy to try to distract attention from this unflattering movie. But it really didn't appear to me that was why he did it. He, you know, he had been, for a number of months, he and his wife had been talking about this education gift. And when his PR team told him not to do this because it might be interpreted this way, and so he said, "Well, okay, I'll just make an anonymous contribution. I'll give it to them anonymously." And Booker and Christie said, "No. We need you to go public because otherwise we'll never raise the matching $100 million, which was a condition of the gift." And so Zuckerberg told me that he did a quick calculation in his head and realized that the number of people who were going to see this movie was actually a tiny fraction of those who were already logging onto Facebook every day. And so he figured it was worth the risk that the company would survive. The movie didn't hurt him at all, as it turned out.
Makes sense. So Zuckerberg was the start of the capital. He gave $100 million, where they found another $100 million. What was Cory Booker's role? Was he just this fantastic, iconic figure who was able to raise money and bring attention and draw people to a small town called Newark, New Jersey?
Yes. In fact, it was funny because in the course of the book, I interviewed a couple of U.S. senators who, this was before Cory Booker was in the Senate, and they were wondering, how is it possible that this mayor of this godforsaken little city raises more money than we do? You know, right. What is it about him? But he has a brilliant ability to attract national attention to issues, and often issues that other people aren't paying attention to, like the education of, you know, the poorest kids in the inner cities. Currently, mass incarceration is a big issue of his. But what he doesn't tend to do as well is to follow up with, you know, the sort of patient, unglamorous, tedious work that comes with trying to turn some of these promises into reality. And so I think that Mark Zuckerberg didn't know that Booker wasn't going to be as dazzling a partner all along the way as he was at the beginning.
But also in Newark, unlike other cities, there's no mayoral control. He was not in charge of education, right?
That's no, where in fact, there's in. No local control. The Newark schools, as I said, in 1995, had been taken over by the state government because of corruption and the terrible failure to serve kids. And so even though the state wasn't doing much to improve the outcomes for kids, that no governor had ever given the schools back to Newark. And so just it's now 20 years that they've been in state.
So Booker's role, I mean, he didn't have any direct control. He was just trying to help the city and bring attention and money towards the problem, whereas he wasn't in charge of anything in terms of schools are concerned.
Right. But Christie had told him that he would be his unofficial partner on the ground in terms of this whole education enterprise. And, you know, Booker just, he continued to give some speeches and, you know, sort of tout the effort, but he didn't work to try to organize any kind of grassroots movement of people to support this.
So the third player in this is Chris Christie, who was the governor of New Jersey. What was his role in all this?
Well, he was, you know, he's the guy in charge, and so
he had direct control of Newark public schools.
The governor through the state education commissioner controls the schools. And so his own role was just, you know, kind of sporadic, but he did appoint an education commissioner who made this his life's mission to try to change the situation on the ground in Newark. And so he was a very dogged, ardent, you know, actor in this. So Christie did have an agent who was active every day.
But he wasn't the fundraiser, he wasn't the front man, he wasn't
Not as much, okay. No. Although at the very end, when Booker was not able to raise all the money, Christie phoned up, you know, a bunch of his traditional fundraisers and basically got them to give about $20 million to finish the matching.
Great. So he did help in that.
Yeah.
And then the fourth player in this is the superintendent. Then.
Yes.
It wasn't their first choice, from what I understand, Cammy Anderson.
Yes. Yes. She came. She had been an assistant superintendent in New York City under Joel Klein, who was the chancellor in New York and was kind of a hero of all of the education reformers because of the work he was doing there. And she had been this in charge of alternative high schools in New York City. So these were like the kids who were in prison, you know, in the city prisons. They, you know, she was in charge of their education, the pregnant teenagers, adults who had dropped out and came back to school. She was in charge of all of those. I think she had like 60,000 students that
Wow.
she was in charge of. And she was fascinating because her feeling, you know, a big part of this plan was to expand charter schools. And because she had experience with these kids that had, you know, the most extreme needs, she had some questions about whether charters served all kids. Because in New York, while there had been great expansion of charter schools, you know, throughout the city, she said there charters weren't interested in her kids. Like, no, she wanted a charter school to develop, you know, a high expectations program for the kids in prison, and nobody was interested in doing that. So her feeling was, you know, she was very kind of upfront with Christie and Booker that, you know, you really, if you're going to expand charters, you better make sure that they're serving all kids, because otherwise you're not addressing the real problem. You're just creaming the top of the problem.
Makes
and she would say things like, you know, this is like the lifeboat theory of education reform, that you're just basically putting everybody on little boats while the big ship is sinking.
Right.
And
right.
You know, she was very outspoken and kind of off message in their view with what they wanted to do.
And she was appointed by Christie.
Yes. Yeah.
So let's cut to the punchline, and we'll back into it. The question in your book: who is in charge of American public schools?
Well, I kind of intended that to be just a question that's out there, because I think that there's a struggle, you know, that's constant over who's in charge, and parents are struggling at one end, political bosses in every community are struggling, unions are struggling, philanthropists are now a factor, you know, in terms of
right.
trying to reshape districts and certain cities. And so I think that what's going on now in education with the fight over the Common Core and standardized testing, you know, there's a pitched battle that's, and it seems like, you know, we feel it particularly now, but it's been going on forever.
So let's answer it for Newark. Who was the quarterback of the strategy? It seemed like Booker was more the fundraiser. Christie was he was in charge, but he was on boots on the ground. Zuckerberg gave a handsome sum of money, and they raised
very
it.
Handsome.
But who was actually running their strategy and the goals that they had set out with this money?
Well, part of the problem was it was very unclear who was, you know, who was the quarterback.
Right.
You know, the superintendent certainly was a very, you know, forceful figure, and she was the one trying to fix the district schools, which were struggling so much. But then the state commissioner, you know, who had all of the power and controlled everything, was a big factor. And the funders had their own ideas of what money, where they wanted the money to go. So it was, you know, it was one of these situations where it was hard to know who was really in charge and who was accountable for the changes or for making changes.
Interesting. And then, so one of the themes I see in the book is that I know there was a lot of successes, we'll talk about those, but the failure of this money and the strategy they had set out to do was due to a lack of community engagement. Was it really about community engagement? If they had just done more community engagement, we would have seen a different outcome, or is that yet a process issue?
Well, when you talk about community engagement, it's not just like, you know, having nice sessions and telling everyone what you're doing. I think it's really trying to understand what the problems are at the school level and what needs to change. And there were, as I was saying, there were so many teachers in the district schools who were working their hearts out and saw very clearly what needed to change. And, you know, I I think that had that been part of the, had their insights been part of the planning process, it might have really been a different situation. But what happened was that there was a political explosion in Newark because there was so little participation from the community. And, you know, there was a plan from the beginning to expand the charter schools, to close quite a few district schools, to, you know, there would have had to been layoffs as a result of that. And there was no conversation with the community about all of these consequences that were coming. It was just that, they started happening. And the phrase that everyone used was, reform is being done to us, not with us.
But it seemed like Cami Anderson didn't have a good way to get community engagement. The one time she tried, it was pretty disastrous.
Well, she had a certain, you know, personality about her that, I mean, I think it was both her greatest strength and her greatest flaw, was that she was so forceful and so convinced that, you know, she knew what to do and she knew what was right. So when she came up with a plan that was this enormously comprehensive plan to close district schools, replace some with charters, move children around, and they changed the whole system of how you get into a school instead of just going to your neighborhood school, which people had done forever in Newark. There had never been anything but neighborhood schools. They created something called universal enrollment so that everyone could apply to any school and go anywhere in the city, although there wasn't going to be any busing to get them there, and only 60% of people in Newark own a car. So it just, like, you know, it was one of these things that was a great, you know, it's sort of a great theoretical plan that didn't really mesh with
the
facts on the ground of people's lives. And so it just, you know, there was such opposition that a candidate who was his entire, well, I mean, most of his platform was that he was running against these changes and against education reform. And even his opponent, who was running in favor of education reform, acted like he was running against Cami Anderson, you know, because that she was just that unpopular with everybody, the proponents and the opponents of reform. And so the new mayor was elected who really was an opponent of everything that was happening.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to Dale Rusakoff, journalist and author of a new book about education reform called The Prize, Who is in Charge of America's Schools? I'm Mohammed Chaudhry, President and CEO for the Silicon Valley Education Foundation, SVEF, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. So we've got a lot of audience questions, some are around the theme. So now we've got the players. Community engagement is a large challenge, and seemed like the only quarterback that we've identified is Cami. That wasn't her strong suit. The other challenge I see from the audience questions is around the unions. What role did they play? I mean, Randy Weingarten was involved. This is the AFT. There was a large sum of money that went to back pay for some reason, $50 million to pay retro. Was that table stakes? How did the unions get involved, and what was Zuckerberg's goal for systems change in terms of unions?
Well, I think that he wanted to see a contract that would, dramatically change the rules that unions had always insisted on in education. And he wanted to see seniority no longer be a factor in how teachers were paid or how they were protected. And he wanted teachers to be paid purely, you know, to get raises purely based on their merit and not on how long they'd been teachers, which was, you know, a complete change in the way it was going, the way it had been. He wasn't able to get that done, because what he didn't realize was that the seniority protections in New Jersey are not a matter of a contract, they're a matter of state law. And so in order
to get... Did that just get missed completely?
Yes. I mean, there was a certain problem with the due diligence, I think.
But there was also $1,000 a day consultant. I mean, there's bright people working on this. The due diligence was just way off?
Well, the consultants came in after the gift was announced.
Sure.
So I honestly think that Cory Booker told him, we've got this, you know, we'll get this contract, we'll fix seniority, we'll do all these things. And I think he just believed him.
Interesting, interesting. So now, what was the contract? Why the $50 million was back pay, but that was kind of table stakes. But what was there a new contract that was better? I mean, the union did bend in this contract versus others.
The union did bend. The back pay. The union got $31 million, not $50 million.
Excuse me.
That's okay. Yeah. It's still a lot of money, and yeah. Zuckerberg paid that with a check. And that was their demand. They would not come to the table unless they got $31 million in back pay for the 3 years that they had worked without raises. So he agreed to do that just to get them to the table.
And in return for what?
In return for this is going to sound so minor, but it's a big deal in teachers' union contracts. Teachers used to get a raise every year pretty much regardless of their performance. And now in Newark, you only get a raise if you are rated effective or highly effective. If you're ineffective or partially effective, it's a 4-point scale, you don't get your raise. And that's pretty significant because over time, it could mean that, you know, the stronger teachers stay in the district and the weaker teachers leave, as opposed to just everybody staying and getting their raises and having a secure long-term job.
So inside baseball, was this transformative, or was this just yet another contract?
Well, it wasn't transformative, and it wasn't something that, you know, Zuckerberg had hoped that they would have a contract that would be so revolutionary that it would be copied in city after city and it would become, you know, just sort of a change agent in education. Yeah. And that, you know, it definitely didn't rise to that. But it was one of these things that kind of showed you how hard it is, I mean, to get the players to move in a significant way. So the union did, you know, they made that move, and that was considered, you know, a huge step. But in terms of, you know, how that affects what happens in schools and in classrooms, it's going to take years before we know if it makes a difference.
So the fundamental question from a research standpoint and from one of our audience members is, does adjusting teacher pay and benefits school, does that really make schools better? Is there a correlation there or causation there?
Well, there's no evidence in research at all that merit pay translates into higher student achievement. And that was the other, when you said $50 million, the yeah. contract did cost the, you know, Zuckerberg and the other funders $50 million. And there was about $6 million in merit pay, which is a very small amount when you contrast it to $31 million in back pay. But the teachers that I talked to who got merit pay, and it was like $5,000 for some, $10,000 for, it was $5,000 if you were rated at the highest level, highly effective, in any school. But if you were in one of the highest poverty schools, it was $10,000. And if you were teaching in a subject that was hard to staff, like high school science or math, it was $12,500. And so the teachers, I talked to a number of teachers who got the $10,000 amount, and they said that, you know, they were thrilled to have the money, it was great, but it really had no effect on how they taught, because what rewarded them was their students, you know, and seeing their students improve was the prize to them. And I think that the education reform movement is totally focused on this merit pay and paying teachers based on, you know, their students' test scores or their students' performance. And I think that the way, I mean, this is what Zuckerberg said to me, is that he feels that the most talented people in the country are, you know, if, I mean, in his industry, he has access to the most talented graduates from all over the world. They all want to come to Facebook. You know, it's a great place to work, but it's also very rewarding. And he feels that public education is not going to get that caliber of person until it pays, you know, for performance, and until people know they'll get reward for their performance.
And was this a fundamental gap of A, not understanding the research, and B, a business mindset that just doesn't work in education, and there's a total myth?
Well, I think it was, you know, I think that they may have read the research, they may have known what it says, but I think they just don't buy it, and they think that they'll attract a different kind of person if they pay by performance.
Okay, so those are the unions. Now let's talk about the theme of charter schools. You talked about charter schools that they came in from a resource perspective, whereas in New Jersey, the per student spend is over.
Well, in Newark, it's $20,000 per student.
And to put that in context, in California, it's $9,000.
Yeah, right.
So despite the $20,000, they weren't, and we'll talk about why.
And in New Jersey statewide, it's $16,000. Newark gets more because there, you know, there long-standing court decisions and state laws that came from it that require higher funding in the highest poverty districts.
And so, this is $20,000 of government tax dollars. This is not the philanthropy.
No. Right? This is just government money.
So charter schools came in. There's a notion of charter schools really help. You talked about it a little earlier as well. What was the tension between charter schools and traditional public schools? You had a couple of examples, great examples of the efforts of Princess Williams at Brick Avon. Or is it necessary for teachers to leave traditional public schools to truly be transformative teachers?
Well, that was a really fascinating and disturbing case. This was an absolutely amazing teacher. She's the teacher I referred to who has who had 26 kindergarten children, of whom 15 had child welfare cases. I'd never seen a teacher like this, and she had been recruited by the two highest performing charter school networks for years, and she didn't want to go. She wanted to stay in the district. She said, "My mission is to help the traditional district schools." And it's crazy when you think they have $20,000 per student. But just to give you an idea, the school where she worked, only $8,000 per student reached the school.
Where did the rest of the money go?
Central office. And I have to plead complete, I just couldn't figure out how is it possible that much money is being spent at the central office level. Some of it is funding services that go to the schools, but at ridiculous costs. So, for example, they pay for custodial services, and the district office gave me a printout, and they said that they spend $1,200 per student on custodial services. The charter schools spend $400 per student on custodial services. And so you just have to wonder, well, what goes into that? You know, they have like, you know, are there a million clerks who work in the custodial services and they're charging their salaries?
Also appeared there were some people, due to the politics, there were people being parked in the central offices for favors and whatnot as well. There's even some notion of even Booker and others parked people there. So there's a lot of people, quote unquote, hanging out at the district office.
Right. There are fewer now because they've had to really, because as kids have gone to charters, the money goes with them and the district has had to downsize dramatically. So there's a lot, they have had to eliminate a lot of jobs that were just sitting there before.
So let's talk about that. So as the number of charter students increase in the district, there was all these teachers in the traditional public school. Charters are public schools as well, but the traditional public schools, every time a classroom went to a charter, what happened to those teachers? They still have their contract and tenure, right?
Well, the law would have required the district to lay off the excess teachers in order of reverse seniority. So in other words, the last hired would be the first fired. And Cami Anderson just said, I'm going to refuse to do that. Because she wanted to be able to fire to let teachers go based on merit. So in other words, keep the teachers who were the best for kids and let go the teachers who were the weakest. And because she couldn't do that, she decided to create an excess pool with the encouragement of the state commissioner of education, Christie's point man. They said they would just continue to pay these teachers not to teach. And it's not like they didn't just sit in a rubber room, which they did in New York. They actually sent them to school buildings to be an extra pair of hands. So, I was at Avon Avenue School, which was one of the schools I spent a lot of time in, there were a couple of art teachers who were left over, and they sent them. One of them turned out to be excellent. She was just, a teacher who... she was excessed, and she'd been in the district a long time, and she just refused to apply for another job in a school. She said, "They owe me my job." So that she had this attitude, which was just a product of the union contract.
So how well did the charter schools work? It appeared they did work better. They were more effective, at least, than the Newark public schools. Is that true?
In Newark, they are, as a group, and there's a couple of charter networks in Newark that are extremely effective, and the kids far outperform not only the Newark schools, but even the state average.
One of the questions from the audience is, do the charter schools get more money because they raise additional resources, philanthropic resources as well? So are they literally spending more money to get those results?
You know, the reason that they have more money at the classroom level is really just because of the much leaner management that they have. Because the philanthropy that they get, they use it to subsidize their schools as they're starting up. Because they start with only one grade and then two grades and then three grades. And so that's not, there's not, you know, you're funded per kid. So they don't have enough money initially to pay for the whole building staff. So they use philanthropy to subsidize the deficits in those schools. But once the schools are fully built out, I asked them to show me, they do not spend philanthropy in the schools after that point. They spend it on real estate, like when they have to, you know, take a district school building and renovate it, or when they actually, in some cases, build a new school. But they run their schools based on public dollars, not on philanthropy.
And so what implications does this have? I mean, you mentioned Eli Broden and Los Angeles Unified a little closer to home. The goal of 50% of LA Unified schools going to become charter schools. Who's responsible for the traditional public schools? Is it philanthropy or is it someone else? I mean, how does this play out? Because it seems like that's still the case where a lot of philanthropists truly believe that the solution is to bring in charter schools versus to reform the traditional public schools.
Right. Well, I don't know how the governance works in LA, but in Newark, the charters are they're chartered by the state, and it's the state that's in charge of them, and the local district is a completely separate organization, and they're basically in a position of just trying to react to the changes. They have no control over the growth rate.
Yeah.
It's competition.
That's,
yeah.
It's fine.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like FedEx and the post office or something. You know, it's just this new lean competitor that comes into the market and doesn't have the legacy costs and doesn't have, you know, the older employees or any of the things that make it more expensive to operate.
So let's step back. There's $200 million that went into this, about 40,000 kids. So that's a significant amount of money. What worked with that money? What did they actually do? Did they do anything well that really helped the district, or was it just lost in $1,000 consultants and?
You know, I think that there was such an obsession with this kind of systems change and management change that. And I do think they made improvements there. The district was running, it ran so poorly, it was kind of astonishing how dysfunctional the bureaucracy and the management was. So I think they did improve the teacher evaluation system, they got some better assistant superintendents who were doing a much better job of monitoring the schools and supporting the principals and making sure that they had, you know, teams of people to help train and support teachers. I mean, there's a lot of kind of infrastructure that's better, but the schools themselves seem to be fairly overwhelmed by the changes that have taken place and all of the layoffs and the influx of students from the closed schools. So it's just, you know, it's hard to see that at this point you can't see that there's been an improvement in the district schools.
So part of the theme here, the takeaway that some people are feeling is if someone with a philanthropist with $100 million that puts it into traditional public schools can't make a notable impact, our dollars, individual dollars from $100 to a lesser amount, I mean, is education even worth investing in? And then you tell a story of the different mindsets, I believe, of Priscilla Chan, Zuckerberg's wife, and him. He's more of a systems change person. She seemed more boots on the ground, holistic approach, where you bring the tooth mobile and you bring the vision and the healthcare to the schools, you know, the holistically fix one school at a time. Would it, would Would Priscilla Chan's approach, the way you described it, would that have been helpful in doing more to impact these schools?
Well, I think that had there been both approaches, that could have been really powerful. But I think that because there wasn't really a focus on the classroom level and what the needs were at that point between teachers and kids, that they're really, you know, I think that's where change really happens in education. And
so there's another question about the magic of the 5-year number. I mean, students are in school for 13 years.
Right,
so
right.
5 years, this arbitrary number to fix a system, was that realistic?
No, it wasn't. And I think that they were they were trying to do it on a politician's timetable and not so much on the timetable of what it takes to change schools. I think this is, you know, I mean, it's a perpetual process. It's not just something that happens in 5 years. It could take a generation. And if you don't think of it that way and you don't think of having it sustained, you know, over time, well beyond the election of a mayor or the election of a governor, it's not going to have any kind of a lasting impact.
On the softer side, were there any family or classroom stories that did not make the book that were truly transformative? I mean, some of the stories that you've told are just amazing. These superheroes, teachers, these families who are really challenged with adversity. Were there any stories that didn't make it in the book?
Oh, wow. Let's see. Well, I was going to tell you about a family that I followed for a long time and then didn't put in the book, but it wasn't a family of superheroes. it was a family that was an extremely. I was following this family of five girls in one school, and that was a kindergarten through eighth grade school, and the family was so troubled, and at this particular school, the principal and the vice principal and the parent liaison had gotten so involved with these kids. They were, you know, the kids weren't coming to school in part because their clothes were dirty every day. So they were actually laundering their clothes for them and making sure that when they said, just come to school in whatever you want, and I'll have your clothes clean for you when you get here, and you could just put them on. And it was like that was how they got these girls to start coming to school. It was just amazing what it took, just, you know, sort of lifting up these kids. But it was interesting because the teachers, a couple of them, had grown up in the same circumstances as these girls, and they had been ashamed to come to school when their clothes were dirty.
Wow.
And they understood. It was really strange because they were there was another school. It happened to be a charter school, and the funders went to visit it, and the charter school principal was saying, we can't get the kids to wear their uniforms. It's so frustrating. And at this other school, they weren't wearing their uniforms either because they were dirty, you know, and if the teachers washed them, then they could put them on. And so I just thought it was so striking, these teachers who really had this connection to where these kids came from and what their lives were like, just had a whole extra order of magnitude in their ability to reach them. The reason that didn't get in was that these girls had two parents in their lives, but the parents were separated, and they were both emotionally disturbed. And they got really almost, they started just having a lot of violence between them. And I just kind of felt like it was such an extreme case that it wouldn't be fair to them to write about it. And it wouldn't be fair to the book either, because I don't think they were that representative of any, you know, other families. But what it struck me was just the role of these teachers in trying to reach these
kids. But that also tells the story of the theme of the book around community engagement. For a teacher to know that the reason they're not wearing those uniforms is because they're dirty.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be obvious to someone sitting 3,000 miles away or 100 miles away to understand those problems.
Right, or just somebody in another school who didn't come from there and just thought these kids are being jerks, they're not wearing their uniforms.
Exactly. So what could the parents and the community have done? Is there anything more they could have done, or is there anything they can do now?
You know, actually, right now, the schools are in the process of being returned to Newark for local control. Governor Christie, I think, has decided that his presidential campaign is too distracting and he just can't deal with Newark anymore. So he, after, you know, saying he would just absolutely not consider returning the schools to Newark, has now said that he's going to over a period of time. And his state commissioner has now taken the job of superintendent. They forced out Cammy Anderson. Okay. They decided that she was toxic and that the community would never stop protesting if she didn't exit stage left. So she's gone, and the state commissioner is now running the district and is being, you know, much more collegial and, you know.
The community engagement's happening.
It's happening. It's happening more. But when you asked what parents can do, for the first time in 20 years now, the people in Newark are going to have control again, and they're going to be able to elect a school board that will actually have power and not be just an advisory school board that basically doesn't have anything to say about education. And so there seems to be like a really interesting coalescing of grassroots organizations to recruit extremely qualified people from the community to run for the school board, you know, retired teachers and principals who just like, they're not ideologues. They just know what children need, and they know how schools run and what it takes to improve a school and improve a district. And they're trying to get people like that to run for the school board and to build a big base of support for them. And it's really fantastic, because the whole time I was watching this process in Newark, you know, the politics of education were that everybody in Newark just wanted the state out, and they protested everything the state did because they just wanted to have local control back. And now, with the prospect of it coming back, it's sort of changing from this really negative politics to something that feels more positive. But in order for those people to get elected, it's going to take a huge amount of organizing, and I think if parents do that, they could have a real they could help improve the schools.
So some of these players are in Silicon Valley in your book, in addition to Zuckerberg. The Community Foundation, the Silicon Valley Community Foundation was involved in this as well. Now, recently, Zuckerberg also announced that he's going to put money back to the Bay Area. What should he do different to not fall into the trap? Remember, here, from $20,000 a student, there's only going $9,000 going to, on average, is going to students in California. What can he do different in the Bay Area? What are the lessons for Bay Area philanthropists as they go down this path? I know he's announced a couple of communities where he'll start. He'll be more community-minded about it. But what are the other lessons?
Well, I think those are big lessons, because I think that, you know, what he and he's got a staff of, in his philanthropy, and he's actually gotten them to now just spend an awful lot of time at the grassroots level in the communities where they think they're going to do their work. So that, you know, as he and his wife said, that they wrote an op-ed, I think, last year.
The Mercury News.
Yeah, and they said that they want to really get to know the problems that, you know, the challenges that face kids in classrooms, so that they can address the needs that others miss. And I think that that is just, you know, incredibly positive. And I thought it was just so interesting that, you know, he, as you said, you know, he's this kind of boy wonder and tech genius, and he came to this in a humble way. He's changed his perspective on
it. Quick lightning round questions. Is it still worth for philanthropists to invest in traditional public schools?
I think it is, but I think that there really has to be a clear plan to, I mean, if I were a philanthropist, I would have an almost forensic accounting done of a school district to see where money is going, and then try to have a transparent process with the community and say, this is where money is going, this is where it could be going to support your kids, what are the difficult trade-offs we're willing to make to get money to these kids? And I think that could really be transformative. I hate the word, but
we reached the point in our program where there is only time for one last question. So tell us the five big takeaways. One more time. What are the five lessons from Newark that for philanthropists, for school leaders, for unions, and for the community from this experiment?
Well, I think, you know, no hubris. That's the first takeaway. I think that to come in and tell a community this is what's wrong with you and we're going to fix you is just a dead end, and it exploded in Newark, and I think it would have a similar effect almost anywhere. I think also figuring out how to get money to the school level, because the needs of kids are so different one neighborhood to the next, one school to the next. And I think that that's a... That is a really challenging political enterprise to try to get money out of school districts and into schools. But, you can see the best charter schools do it. You know, they're getting those resources mobilized in a way that support kids. So it seems like that's, you know, if you were going to invest in a school district, you would want to figure out how to do the same thing. Other things, I think I would, if I were, you know, I mean, I'm sure that this is the kind of thing that Zuckerberg's philanthropy staff is doing, but I would go to some of the lowest performing schools and find the best teachers in them and try to learn from them what needs to change in this school and in this district so that you can do the work you need to do. And I think that that's something that didn't happen in Newark. I don't even know if it ever happens, but there's, you know, I mean, teachers who day after day come in and do amazing work under those circumstances have so much to share, and they should definitely be at the table. I don't know if I have five takeaways. So.
That's good. That's great. Okay. Thank you. Our thanks to Dale Rosikoff, journalist and author of a new book about education reform called The Prize, Who is in Charge of America's Schools? We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Mohammed Chaudhry, President and CEO for the Silicon Valley Education Foundation, SVEF, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.